we three kings of Orient are, introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others, and perhaps we're kicking off the Christmas season a little bit early here in October, joining the marketing trend. It's not even Halloween, but we've got a really interesting new book coming out that you'll want to get for your kids for this upcoming Christmas season. The Wise Men Who Found Christmas by Catholic journalist and author Raymond Arroyo, familiar to many on EWTN, the Eternal Word Television Network, Catholic journalist and author. It's an excellent children's book, and it's also, it really raises intriguing questions for people of all ages. And we want to discuss this book and the important historic background of it and the questions raised in it. Well, Raymond Arroyo, thank you for joining the show.
Oh, Andrew, the pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me.
Well, just starting out here, this is a really neat book, well illustrated by your co-author or colleague, Diane LaFayre. Who were the Magi or the three wise men? What do we know
well,
about
you know,
that?
Andrew, these are the most beloved figures of Christmas, and they've done a lot of polling internationally. And as you know, the Christmas season is really celebrated on the Feast of the Epiphany, which is January 6th in many parts of the world. That is the day that commemorates the wise men coming upon the Christ child and the revelation to the Gentiles, as the saying goes. I was always fascinated by who these guys were. I think they're so fixed in the popular imagination. So I started researching, and what I discovered is everything I thought I knew about the wise men turned out to be wrong or incorrect, vastly incorrect in some areas. And you know that song you played in, you know, on the way in here, sort of laid the groundwork, I think, for a lot of our understanding of these magi. They were probably more than three of them, A. B, they were not kings. And see, they did not come from the Far East. So, you know, they were from the Orient. Orient just means east. But east of Judea, they probably came from Arabia, not from the Far East. So once you start burrowing down, which I did, and look, I read a lot of biblical scholarship, current archaeological scholarship, as well as historians of the era. When you start digging down, you realize even in the first century, Justin Martyr and Eusebius and Tertullian, all of these guys say the wise men came from east of Judea. Justin Martyr's even more explicit. He said they came from Arabia. Well, the kingdom of Arabia at the time would have been current-day Petra, okay, where the city of Petra is, where you see those beautiful carved out of the mountains. That is where, in all likelihood, if once you string all of this together, that is very likely where the Magi came from. And Magi were nothing more than, you know, stargazers, dream readers, consultants to kings, educated men with the implements and understanding of the time. And a lot of that was prophecy and stargazing. They were very likely members of a priestly cult, whether they were Zoroastrian or Jewish, old priests of the Jewish First Temple. That's unclear, but we do know where they came from, and I think we know why they went on this journey. And so I decided to take the historical setting and the political context and turn that into an adventure, which I think it was. This is really a buddy movie, if you will. It's an adventure of men who are seeking something that they can't quite see, that isn't quite clear to them, but they know they have to pursue this truth. And I think that's part of why they resonate with all of us, particularly this time of year, and why they haunt us each Christmas anew.
Well, these names that you have in the book, Melchior, Balthazar, and Gaspar, where do these names come from? I mean, what evidence do we have for these names?
Well, Andrew, with the names, that was something I decided to just keep the cultural and sort of traditional names of these characters. The truth is, we don't know what their names were. If you go back into Armenian texts and Syrian ancient texts, that some of them concurrent with the Bible, the names are unpronounceable of these wise men. I mean, some of them, you know, Chakalakavan. I mean, the names are just, they're a jumble of letters. It wasn't until really the 8th century that Venerable Bede comes up with Melchior, Balthazar, and Caspar and gives them, assigns age to them, okay, so that Melchior was the older man, Balthazar was the middle-aged man, Caspar was the younger man. So I took that iconography, if you will, and decided to carry that into the tale just because it's the traditional understanding and it gives us a little framework of these characters. Now, here's the fascinating thing that I didn't know. Those three names, and by the way, if you check the bottom of your Fontanini boxes when you buy the wise men figurines for Under the Tree, you'll notice this is the names they give them, Melchior and Balthazar and Caspar. What I didn't know is each of those names is just king in different languages. Melchior is Hebrew. Caspar, like Kaiser, is German. They all are derivatives of king in various tongues. That's what those three names mean. And the ages, the reason Venerable Bede gave them ages of old age, middle age, younger man, is to show how the faith is transferred down from one generation to the next, and that old to the young are receptive to the call of God and the pull of God, particularly at this time of year.
Well, yeah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, Melchior, so I guess Melech is in Hebrew is king, and you say Caspar, well, Kaiser in German is derived from Caesar, or in Latin pronounced with a hard C, Caesar. So that's interesting. So you say Venerable Bede, he took names. So Caspar is sort of a Germanic derivation. Melchior is Hebrew. And what about Balthazar? Where does that come from?
I can't remember now, but I'll have to look it up. I'll do my research for you, figure it out. I can't recall. It's another tongue, and I don't know the derivative at this point. I just forgotten.
Well, that's interesting. And so, you note that we don't know if there were just three or it could have been a group. I mean, it could have been five or so, but historically the number three has come down. Any particular reason for that? Is it because Venerable Bede again?
No. This is sort of a supposition of people, I think, reading. And, in my story, in The Wise Men Who Found Christmas, in the first spread of the book, my illustrator and I talked a lot. And though I don't reference it in the text, you see it visually. There are more than three guys. There are 12, in fact, on the rooftop in Petra who spy the star at its rising, okay? I liked the number 12. Obviously, there were 12 tribes of Israel. There are ancient texts, Syrian texts, Armenian texts of this story that indicate that there were 12 wise men. Okay, now the Coptic Church says there were 60 wise men. So the only reason we all think of three, and why in the popular mind there's always three people, is because the Gospels reference three gifts: the gold, the frankincense, and the myrrh. They never mention the number of wise men or magi who came to the Christ child, just that there were three gifts. So people make the leap that there were three wise men. Well, no, there probably were many more. But I like the number 12. I think when you look, that was a kind of an artistic choice we made when you look at the historic record. That, and I also am now convinced that these magi may well have been priests of the first century temple who were expelled 700 years before Jesus. This is in the Old Testament. And that they went into hiding in Arabia, likely in Petra, and their descendants may have been looking for the Messiah. That makes perfect sense to me. Why? Who else would be looking for a Jewish Messiah but people who had some deep connection to the Jewish faith? And the descendants of that first temple priesthood would have. There's a woman, Margaret Barker, who's done a lot of research, others too, an amazing biblical scholar. I just interviewed her for a Fox Nation special about this. And Margaret is of the mind that they may have well been descendants of that first century priesthood, and I'm partial to her theory.
Well, that's interesting. So there would have been a lineage to these wise men. from the expulsion, the destruction of the first temple under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, the Babylonian exile of the Jews, and then you have had Jews being spread out all throughout the Middle East. That's an interesting theory. I've never heard before.
King Josiah, in the Old Testament, King Josiah cast them out, okay? He purges the first temple. This is, again, it's in the Old Testament. What I loved about it is we know historically, archaeologically, that there was a huge Jewish community in Petra, in what was then known as the Kingdom of Nabatae. And my story starts there. You are in the Kingdom of Nabatae when that star rises, and these wise men go to their king. The king was King Aretas. Again, I love can take stories that we assume we know, and when you dig deeper, you find new realities, new truths that suddenly illuminate the whole scene. And that's what I think, when you look at the wise men, and people often ask me, why focus on the wise men? Why is it important to know the historical context of the wise men? Because if you can pin down the reality of the Magi, then the reality of the mystery they sought, the Christ child in Bethlehem, suddenly, I think, comes into sharp focus. And that's what we should be focused on during Christmas. So my Magi go to their king, King Aretas, the historic figure, and he sends them. They don't just go on their own little procession out to Bethlehem. This was a politically fraught time. And King Herod patrolled his border, okay, between Judea and the rest of the you know, everything to the east, or the west, rather. So you would have had to have a royal diplomatic caravan. You would have had to have been authorized to even go into that territory. And in my retelling, and I think it's true from the historic record, King Aretas sends these Magi as his royal diplomats, if you will, to go bring tribute to what he believes is Herod's new son, the new king of Judea. And that's where the story kind of begins. And so this is an adventure for the family, but it also is an exploration into the history and the wonder of the time and the mystery of this Christ child that these wise men go in pursuit of, to great peril, by the way, to great peril and risk to their own lives and fortunes.
That's interesting. So this king in the book, this King Aretas of Nabatea, you're saying he would have wanted to sort of ally himself with King Herod. Why would that be so? Is it because King Herod was simply a clone of the Romans, so King Aretas would have wanted to be on good relations with King Herod, and therefore, would have responded to this vision of the Magi that King Herod has had a son, King Aretas is assuming that this Messiah is going to be the son of King Herod, so King Aretas would want to show tribute to this person.
Well, this is where I think, like most things, people operate on two levels or three levels. You know, all of us we have multi agendas going on inside of everybody. On the part of Aretas, look, he's a politician. They're both under the Romans. Judea and the Kingdom of Nabatea were under the control of the Romans, but they were separate empires. And Herod had invaded this Kingdom of Nabatea about 30 years earlier. So they were not on the best of terms, but the trade routes that Nabatea controlled ran into Judea. So Aretas needed to keep good relations with Herod. Herod was also, by the way, Herod's mother was a Nabatean princess. So there's kin there as well. They were related behind the scenes. But Aretas certainly knew Herod was a murderous, brutal, dictator in his land. He had killed three of his sons and a wife to protect his throne. He was not above brutality, and I think he wanted to keep good relations with him. So when his wise men tell him there's a new king born in Judea, he assumes, okay, Herod must have a new kid. Here, go bring him tribute. Now, the wise men have a different agenda. They have a religious, I think, they're drawn to the star. They're drawn to the prophecies. They want to see this Messiah. So they have a different agenda, but they're all moving in the same direction. And that's why they go to Herod first and don't go right searching for the child. They have to go to Herod first. That's part of the protocol. That's part of the kingly balance at the time. So all of that is kind of worked into this tale of adventure that I tell for families in The Wise Men Who Found Christmas.
Yeah, I guess that's an interesting aspect you bring up here that, you know, if you're traveling in that time as wise men, you know, you can't just get up on your own and sort of like, say, I had a vision, you know, an angel came to me. You know, if you really want to cross these borders or survive or, you know, get along with the authorities, that be, you know, you have to have some political power behind you. So, I guess it's interesting to analyze that you would think that, you know, a group would have to have like a king, like King Arates, and from this this empire of Nabatea supporting them. So there is indeed this interplay between the
And Andrew, I love the idea, and you'll see in the illustrations of the book. You can also go to RaymondArroyo.com. We have a trailer there, some clips of the book and things. But I loved the idea that about 100 years before this moment, when the wise men go pursue this Christ child, at that time in Arabia, horses had been introduced, and they had begun to be bred in Arabia, thus the Arabian horses. The Arabian breed. And the reason that the Arabians are so different from other horses, and I just learned this from a horse trainer the other day, is Arabians have one less rib than other horses, which I did not know. And therefore, their capacity for long distances and their sustainability, even in the heat and the desert, was higher even than camels. So these wise men very likely would not have been on camels clopping through the desert, but on Arabian horses making what was only a 3 to 5 day journey from Petra to Judea and then on to Bethlehem. They actually blew past Bethlehem to get to Jerusalem. So it's a really fascinating story that I think is more enriched, and the scriptures become more alive when you understand the historic context, and that's what I'm trying to do for families. And really, that's why I decided to turn it into a picture book, Andrew, rather than a chapter book, you know, with boring research citations.
That's interesting. So horses, you say, where did horses originally came from to Arabia? I didn't quite get that. They came from Europe originally to Arabia, so that's where we get the Arabian horses, and then sort of with the breeding or such, they developed into the Arabian horse, a new variant.
Correct. They have a new breed. They have their particular breed in Arabia that they were raising that apparently has one less rib than, I guess, the European varietals. But I was stunned when a trainer told me that the other day. He had an Arabian. We actually were shooting a documentary, and he said, oh, this guy's an Arabian. And I said, well, what's the difference? I mean, I see the facial structure is a little different. And then he told me about the rib, and it all made perfect sense why that breed was used in Arabia, could run in the desert, and had that kind of lung capacity.
Well, that's interesting. So, you know, I guess it's another sort of cross-cultural facet. I mean, you know, one thing to note, you know, when we think about Native Americans, you know, the Plains Indians in North America, mm-hmm. and they're on horses. But, of course, horses, you know, came to the Americas through the Spanish conquistadors, and that, you know, some horses escaped and then start to breed, and then the
correct.
Native Americans got horses. So I guess it's another interesting aspect that here too with Arabs in the Arabian culture, they receive horses as well from Europeans. And then, of course, you know, you think about, you know, as with Native Americans, you know, later warfare with, say, Arabs in the Islamic era, that they're riding on horses, but that's something that actually was developed through contact with Europeans.
Correct. Very likely. And again, I like to rescue and kind of rediscover, you know, these figures that we do take for granted, Andrew. I mean, you know, we see these three guys holding the gifts under the tree, and you see them at churches, and you see them depicted in popular art. I mean, I was just at the Metropolitan Museum, and they're all over the place. Everywhere you turn, there's magi. You know, why the cultural fascination with these figures, with these wise men? And that really was what drew me to them. It was a popular part of the nativity iconography that I just wanted to sort of figure out. And, you know, at first I thought, is this just a myth? Is this kind of, you know, St. Matthew just fabulating something at the top of his Gospels or trying to set it off. But it is curious. Matthew starts his Gospel with the Magi. There's a reason for that, I believe. There is a reason for it.
Well, and, you know, talking about myths, I mean, of course, the one thing that you were highlighting here and that you note in your comments on the book is that, you know, the common idea that we have is that these Magi came from Persia, you know, or say Zoroaster, mm-hmm. but you're talking about, no, they probably came from this Arab culture. Well, discuss that a bit. How did this whole idea of Persia come up? And you know, why do you think that the whole Nabataean thesis is more plausible?
Well, because they said they came from from Arabia. And the fact is, the Persians at the time, if you look at the political situation at the time, they were under the control, you know, Persia would have been under the control of the Parthians. They had a very awful, terrible relationship with Herod. There's no way they would have sent Magi from there would have gone. Also, the Persian priesthood, the Zoroastrian priesthood in Persia had declined. I won't get into it, but there was a coup, okay? And they were put down. So the Magi there had all but died out. Any Magi that were, and here we're talking about Zoroastrian remnants that would have remained, would have taken refuge probably in Petra. That was the headquarters of Arabia. That was the New York City of Arabia, if you will, because it was the center of the trade routes. Nabataea controlled all the trade routes. But look, here's the most telling aspect and the reason. There are two reasons, I believe, that Petra and Nabataea were the center of this story and where the Magi originated from. And this isn't Raymond Arroyo. This is reading deeply into the biblical and archaeological evidence that we have. This is kind of a concurrence of opinion among these scholars. The three gifts that are sent, okay, frankincense, gold, and myrrh, Nabataea was known for those three products, if you will. Nabataea controlled the so-called mines of Solomon, the King Solomon's mines, the mines of Midian, sometimes called. Those gold mines, which we still have the empty, you know, remnants of, were controlled by Nabataea. Frankincense and myrrh only grew, it's tree sap, it's created from tree sap in Arabia. In those, it only comes from southern Arabia, within that kingdom. It was one of their main stocks in trade and sought widely at this time because it was burned throughout the Roman Empire, frankincense, incense, because of, you can imagine how people smelled. Well, this kind of cleaned up the smell. So if you had a nice house, you wanted to burn incense in it. And, of course, where else was incense burned? In the temple, in the first temple in Jerusalem. But and of course you have the myrrh, which is a, you know, anesthetic. It is used, you know, we have in the scripture, they put it up to Jesus' lips to take the pain away. So myrrh has its own medicinal qualities. But the fact that those were the three gifts sent to in tribute to Herod, that also points to the place, which is probably this kingdom of Nabataea and Petra. They would have been the only people to have access to these very sought-after and expensive commodities.
Well, I guess then one thing, you know, another thing that comes up here, we've talked about the Magi here, but of course in the story, as your book notes, they're following a star. What star would they have been following?
Well, you're getting into really deep astrology here. And honestly, Andrew, I have read more books on the Star of Bethlehem. Some say it was a constellation, and that it was a conflagration of planets. Others say it was a comet. I interviewed Colin Humphreys, who's a scientist at Cambridge. He believes that it's a confluence of events, that it was Aries, now this is getting very technical, but it was Jupiter rising in the constellation of Aries, which they interpreted at the time, and there's an ancient coin that indicates this, that that would be, Jupiter is Judea, and Aries is the kingly constellation, and therefore they saw there was a new king rising in Judea. Humphrey says what they saw later in Bethlehem may have been a comet. And these are all astral events that you can point to. I mean, they appear in literature of the era. Here's my problem with all of this. There are 1,000 theories about what the star was, but remember, that star comes and goes in this story. Even in Matthew's gospel, they see the star, they run out to it, but the star, they don't see the star again until after they talk to Herod. So they may have seen a multiplicity of things. Here's the focus for us, and I think the most important thing. These were men, as the scriptures say, St. Paul writes, they were keeping their eyes on the things above and not the things of earth. They were searching. They were looking for the unseen. And that's what I think, that has to be our posture at Christmas. We get so wrapped up in the earthly things, in the presents, in the dinners, and who's coming and who's not coming, and I don't want them there, that I think we miss the real moment and reason for this commemoration and this celebration and this season, which is the coming of the Christ child. So whatever they saw in the sky, they were looking in the right place. They were looking up, and that's where we should be focused, I think, this Christmas.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. I guess closing out here, you're a journalist and you're an author and you at the World Over Live on EWTN, you deal with all these political matters and so forth, but you've also been writing books for families and young readers. I mean, how do these two genres of, genres of writing of, for young people on the one hand, or dealing with, for adults on deeper political, spiritual matters on the other hand, how do they interact with each other? How do they affect each other? And how have you come to, encompass both styles of writing?
Well, Andrew, this is the heart of my work. It's a big piece of what I like to do. I love writing for families and young audiences because they still have a sense of wonder. They have a wonderful awareness and sensitivity to the reality of life. I think everybody else gets bogged down in politics, so they run to their corners. Not a child. A child still has wonder. L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, had a great line that I've made my own. And he used to say, I write for the young and the young at heart. And that is what I try to do. And even in TV, whether I'm on Fox or EWTN, it's storytelling to me. I'm telling a story. In this case, I'm exploring a story we thought we knew of these wise men. And I do it intentionally. One, because I do think it's our obligation as writers to enchant and entertain an audience. You have to do that first. And I've labored to do that. And I think the story is exciting and adventurous. It's really like a buddy movie. But there's a touch of whimsy. And there is a supernatural glow around the edges of this story, which I love. And the other part is to educate and help people kind of broaden their understanding. People, an era, a historical moment that, frankly, I knew very little about, despite having been familiar with these characters since I was a child. So, I learned a lot exploring this book, writing this book, and I just wanted to pass a little of that along and hopefully create something that becomes a part of people's Christmas celebration so that, like the wise men who found Christmas, my readers can refind it and rediscover it in a new way for themselves. Andrew? Uh-oh. Did I lose you?
I'm sorry. I forgot that. Oh, yeah, here I am. Yeah, that is, as I was saying, that I think that's an important message of interlinking the spiritual with the political and the world above and the world we live in here and and telling a story and a deeper meaning to events. Well, well, it looks like Raymond Arroyo just dropped here at the end of the show, but I want to thank him for joining the show. It's been a very interesting discussion. We've been listening here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. Here, Raymond's you just dropped it for a moment.
I'm sorry,
there.
I don't know how I got cut off.
Well, that's okay. Well, I guess let's close out here. When's your book coming out, and where can people get it?
The book is out October 11th. It will be available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, or your local bookstore. But look, you can also visit RaymondArroyo.com. I've got a trailer there, links to the show, and I'm touring the country, Andrew, so I hope people will come see me. I'm everywhere. I'm in Nashville and Florida and New Orleans and Arizona, and the Reagan Library, so I hope people will come see me.
Yeah, and I certainly can recommend it, having looked at before. And, well, then, for our listeners out there, you've been listening again to Raymond Arroyo here at Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, and we've been discussing his new book, The Wise Men Who Found Christmas, from Sophia Institute Press. I encourage you all to check it out. And for our listeners out there, tune in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.